From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. On today's show, novel novels.
Give me fat novels stuffed with learning and rare words, lashed with purple prose and black humor. Give me many layered novels that erect a great wall of words for protection against the demons of delusion and irrationality at loose in the world.
That's Stephen Moore, author of the novel An Alternative History. We'll hear from him today. We'll also meet Christopher Miller, author of a novel that's written in the form of liner notes to fictional music. And Jeff Bercy tells us about his book, Verbatim, a novel. Believe it or not, it takes the form of the Hansard, the printed transcripts of parliamentary debates in a Canadian province. But first, Jennifer Egan. Her new novel is called A Visit from the Goon Squad. It's an incredibly inventive work of fiction that's received great acclaim, including the 2010 National Book Critics Circle Award and the 2011 Pulitzer Prize. HBO recently optioned the book for a TV series. Jennifer Egan talked with Steve Paulson about her polyphonic narrative. Here's the very beginning of A Visit from the Goon Squad.
Found objects. It began the usual way in the bathroom of the L'Asimo Hotel. Sasha was adjusting her yellow eyeshadow in the mirror when she noticed a bag on the floor beside the sink that must have belonged to the woman whose peeing she could faintly hear through the vault-like door of a toilet stall. Inside the rim of the bag, barely visible, was a wallet made of pale green leather. It was easy for Sasha to recognize, looking back, that the peeing woman's blind trust had provoked her. We live in a city where people will steal the hair off your head if you give them half a chance, but you leave your stuff lying in plain sight and expect it to be waiting for you when you come back? It made her want to teach the woman a lesson. But this wish only camouflaged the deeper feeling Sasha always had, that fat, tender wallet offering itself to her hand. It seemed so dull, so life as usual, to just leave it there, rather than seize the moment, accept the challenge, take the leap, fly the coop, throw caution to the wind, live dangerously. I get it, Cause, her therapist said, and take the damn thing. You mean steal it? He was trying to get Sasha to use that word, which was harder to avoid in the case of a wallet than with a lot of the things she'd lifted over the past year when her condition, as Cause referred to it, had begun to accelerate. 5 sets of keys, 14 pairs of sunglasses, a child's striped scarf, binoculars, a cheese grater, a pocket knife, 28 bars of soap, and 85 pens, ranging from cheap ballpoints she'd used to sign debit card slips to the Aubergine Visconti that cost $260 online, which she'd lifted from her former boss's lawyer during a contracts meeting. Sasha no longer took anything from stores. Their cold, inert goods didn't tempt her, only from people. Okay, she said, steal it.
Ah, that is wonderful. Thank you so much. Now, the Pulitzer Committee cited your, I'm quoting here, your inventive investigation of growing up and growing old in the digital age, displaying a big-hearted curiosity about cultural change at warp speed. Is that a fair description of your book?
I think it really is, actually. I love the fact that the word curiosity was in there because I didn't really have a clear plan at all when I started this book. In fact, I didn't even really know it would be a book. I thought I was just going to write a story or two. And I really was led by my own curiosity from one peripheral character to the next and tempted to plunge into their inner lives and reveal those lives to the reader. So curiosity was really not only the driving force in writing the book, which is always the case with me, but in a way it was the organizing principle of the book. It was what determined the structure.
Now, it's a very unusual structure, I have to say, and now on the cover it says a novel, but I know some people have described it as a series of interlocking stories rather than a novel. Does it matter how we describe it?
Well, it shouldn't. The word novel was actually not on the hardback. I didn't feel comfortable putting it there because I was worried that it would lead to certain expectations from readers that wouldn't be fulfilled. I don't tend to call it a novel myself. But on the other hand, story collection doesn't seem quite right either. I think it's just one of these works whose genre is a little bit hard to identify. But I will say that one genre I had in mind as I worked on it was that of the 70s concept album, Quadrophenia or Ziggy Stardust or Tommy, where it's one story, but it consists of pieces whose sound, if you will, and tone and feel is extremely different from each other. And there is an A side and a B side in the book.
It's so interesting to hear you say that because you are obviously playing with form here because there are recurring characters and they all kind of fit together in their own way, but the stories are told from multiple viewpoints. One chapter has footnotes, another one is written in PowerPoint form, and I guess it raises the question of whether you consciously set out to try to put it baldly, to reinvent the novel.
I mean, I honestly didn't. I think I was led to whatever reinvention has happened here, and I'm never totally sure about that because if you look back to the beginning of the novel, you know, Cervantes, Don Quixote, and Sterne, Tristram Shandy, those books are so wild and so inventive and seem to, in a way, do almost everything that's been done since. So I sometimes think we don't give credit to the past for a lot of the inventions we think we're coming up with now, but all of that being said, I was really led by the story itself into some of these odd approaches. But I did think that if I was going to write a book that consisted of pieces rather than a central through line, if it was going to be kind of a polyphonic narrative, then I figured why not make that as extreme as possible by having the pieces be as different from each other as they can possibly be and yet still fit together. And the thing that seemed fun about that was that I hoped to encompass a huge range of experience for the reader that could run the gamut from hilarity at times, hopefully, and material that approaches outright farce and certainly satire, and yet very straightforward, at times almost sentimental writing and even tragic. I thought it would be exciting to try to do all of that in one book, and it wouldn't be possible in a book that was told in one central through line because I think it would feel too chaotic.
Now, I'm guessing this is a hard book to describe for someone who has not actually read it because it's told from all these different viewpoints from different characters. And there are, 13 people maybe who were narrating it at various points. But how would you sum it up if you could?
It's about a male record producer and his younger female assistant. And it follows them forward and backward through both of their lives over a period of about 50 years. And it also follows certain peripheral characters in both of their lives. It's very much about time, and it also has a lot to do with the music industry. And in fact, as I said before, is structured like a record album in that each piece sounds different from all of the others, and yet they fit together into one story.
Okay, well, that's pretty good.
What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I have to ask about the title of your book. As you mentioned, Time, the title is A Visit from the Goon Squad. What is the Goon Squad?
Well, the Goon Squad is Time, but I didn't actually know that when I started the book. I had had that title in my mind for a long time, and when I thought of the title, which was maybe, I don't know, 12 years ago, I thought, I'm going to write a book with that title. I wonder what the book will be. And then when I was working on this idiosyncratic book, which, as I said, really sneaked up on me, I didn't know I was writing a book, and then I found myself pulled by my curiosity deeper and deeper into it, I thought, well, maybe this is A Visit from the Goon Squad. But then I thought, well, I have no reason to think that yet. What would the connection be between this book and that title? And then there came a moment fairly early when a publicist goes to visit a former rock star, now ailing and rather unhappy, and he uses the expression, time's a goon, which, as far as I know, doesn't exist, but it sort of came to me in that moment. And as soon as I read that, I thought, ah, yes, okay, this is A Visit from the Goon Squad. And I should say that one other reason it seemed an apt title is that I have two big inspirations in writing this. One was definitely Proust's In Search of Lost Time, which I read over several years with a bunch of friends, having only read a certain way into it as a much younger person. And around the same time that I was reading Proust with these friends, I was also watching The Sopranos, which I really loved. I don't watch much TV, but I thought that that series had a real power and a might to it and really worked its way into my imagination. And I asked myself how I could capture some of what made that show interesting in a book, the kind of decentralized quality of it and the way that peripheral characters would suddenly become central and even seemingly cliched characters would suddenly seem very nuanced and interesting. And those were all things I tried to do in this book. And so I guess a little nod to the goons seemed appropriate.
Well, it's interesting to hear you describe goon as the passage of time, because it suggests that that's very difficult for us to deal with, that passage of time. What it does, and this certainly comes out in your novel, is it shows regret, shows perhaps mistakes in the past, and sort of grappling with what we've done previously in our lives.
For sure. And I think especially the context in which the expression is invoked is really in the physical sense, in the sense that this guy is physically having lots of problems. And I don't know if anyone would say that time is good to us physically in the long haul. But what I was really interested in was change and the shock of change, because I think we're very aware of time on a micro level. You know, I'm late. Uh-oh, I left the cookies in too long. That kind of thing. Oh, darn, where did the week go? But the big sense, the heft of time passing and the big changes that it brings seem to often come as a kind of shock. You know, seeing someone you haven't seen in a long time and noticing that they look different, suddenly being aware of how much older your children are. I wanted to get at the surprises and the reversals, which is something Proust was so interested in. You know, the prostitute becomes an aristocrat. You know, his book is full of those shocking, almost unimaginable transformations. But they're positive and negative, and the same is true in Goon Squad. A guy who has been living an almost derelict life is elevated to the status of a folk hero. The ailing rock star doesn't actually end up dying. He ends up recovering and owning a dairy farm. So I was interested in all those little shocks.
Certainly one of the most daring things you've done is you have a chapter told entirely from the perspective. I mean, it's a PowerPoint presentation. It's not just a short chapter, too. It's a really long chapter. And you're conveying a lot of emotional content through a PowerPoint.
Well, I would even go further and say I was able to deliver more emotional content because of the PowerPoint, in the sense that PowerPoint has a cold corporate feel to it. And I think that the balance of that allowed me to be possibly more overtly sentimental than I would ever try to be in a conventional chapter.
So I have to ask you, why did you write a chapter in PowerPoint?
Well, many reasons. Of course, remember that I was trying to find a new technical approach for each chapter. And what that meant was to find a new angle, a new story that would require a different technical approach each time. So I tried all kinds of things. I tried epic poetry, but unfortunately, I'm a horrible poet, so that didn't work out. PowerPoint had been intriguing me for a while, even though I had never actually used it, and I would not call myself very technologically inclined. I didn't know why I was so drawn to it, except that it seemed suddenly to be ubiquitous. And I thought that was the reason. But in fact, once I finally overcame a few hurdles in the form of not having PowerPoint on my computer, not wanting to pay for it, not having enough memory in my laptop to hold it, once I had sort of worked through all of that and actually purchased it and was finally working in it, I realized that what had really been driving me to it the whole time is that PowerPoint as a form is built around the same kind of structure that Goon Squad is, in the sense that it consists of isolated moments with pauses in between them. That's what PowerPoint is. First of all, it allowed me to, in a way, reveal the structural idea behind the book right there. And also, you know, pauses are a big part of our perception of time. It's often when we have a sense that of time briefly stopping that we're aware of its passage. And I had gotten very interested in pauses in songs because they function similarly. Well, the best milieu in which to explore all of that was a form like PowerPoint, which is built around a counterpoint between moments and pauses. So it really ended up serving me well in that particular case, I think.
And it's worth pointing out that one of the characters in that chapter is this young boy who is obsessed with what he calls the great rock and roll pause, you know, these pauses in a song. Why does that idea interest you so much?
Well, it was another case where I wasn't quite sure why it interested me so much. I had encountered it in a book that I had read in doing research on the music industry called So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star by a drummer named Jacob Schlichter, who was with the band Semisonic. And they had a huge hit in 1998 called Closing Time that I think most people would recognize. And there's a pause in that song.
Closing time, time for you to go out to the places you will.
Jacob Schlichter talks about how that pause came to be in the recording of the song, and there was a particular producer involved, Bob Clearmountain, who's known for inserting pauses in songs, and in fact, they are called Clearmountain pauses. I don't know, I just, that idea just caught in my mind, and I was dying to somehow use pauses in the book, but I couldn't find the right way. I had an academic at one point. He was writing a book about pauses in songs, but that particular piece never quite worked. But I think the reason I was so obsessed with it actually was exactly the same thing that led me to the PowerPoint. So it was perfect that they all converge, which was that pauses make us know that time is passing. There's a pause and you think maybe the song has ended, but then the song continues and you're relieved. But then you also know that the song will actually end. And in a certain way, that's a metaphor for the way we perceive time in our lives.
Well, it's interesting also to hear this from the perspective of a fiction writer, because I suppose it would be very easy just to write a novel that kind of races along, that doesn't give you that time for pausing. But that's not what you wanted to do. I mean, you wanted to sort of force us to step back and reflect and think about things, think about how things turned out the way they did, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, I felt, too, that just letting time unfold in a more real-time way, which is what Proust did, didn't feel, well, first of all, it would just be literally mimicking him, but also it didn't quite feel of this moment. I think we live in a moment that's full of gaps and shortcuts and a sense of speeding up, a sense of acceleration, and then moments when that acceleration seems to stop. I guess we live in a moment that feels kind of herky-jerky to me, and I guess I just wanted to capture a sense of that and to suggest a whole epic sweep, but in little parts, through the refraction of little parts, rather than one huge, long monster of a whole.
Closing time. Every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end.
Jennifer Egan is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel A Visit from the Goon Squad. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Egan actually created a PowerPoint presentation based on the PowerPoint chapter in the book. You can watch it on her website. You'll find a link to her website on our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to the original uncut interview with Egan at our website and a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, we'll explore the history of experimental novels, and later, novels inspired by liner notes and transcripts of parliamentary debates, as we continue our Hour on Novel Novels. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Stephen Moore is the author of several books and essays on modern literature. His latest is a massive doorstop called The Novel, An Alternative History, Beginnings to 1600. And yes, as the title indicates, there will be a sequel. Moore talked to Steve Paulson about his book.
My main interest is in what they call experimental, alternative, avant-garde kind of fiction. And I want to argue in my book that that's not a 20th century phenomenon, which a lot of people think it is, you know, started with James Joyce or something, but that there's always been an avant-garde. In every generation going back as far as you want to go back, there's always a small number of writers who are pushing the envelope. So it's a history of those oddball novels throughout the millennia, as well as a different way of looking at the whole history of the novel as an art form.
In the introduction to your book, you write that you seriously thought about writing this, starting in around 2002, because of two things that happened that year. Can you explain what they were?
Yeah, one was the discovery of this huge, crazy novel written back in 1499 called the Hypnerotomachia Polyphili. It means the strife of Polyphilo, by Francisco Colonna. And I was knocked out by it because it's a huge 500-page book that looks like Finnegan's Wake. It's all a novel, a dream novel, that is, written in this artificial language made up of Latin and Italian and Greek. very much like what Joyce was doing with Finnegan's Wake in 1939. And I wondered, how come I never heard of this book? I mean, it's an incredible work of fiction. And then the second thing, I began seeing a kind of conservative backlash against the kind of fiction I like, the experimental avant-garde stuff. First there was Dale Peck, and then there was a guy named Arnold Myers who wrote a book called The Reader's Manifesto. And then even Jonathan Franzen, who wrote a review of William Gaddis's posthumous works, complaining about how difficult Gaddis and Gaddis's forerunners are and how he didn't like that kind of fiction. At that point, I just had it. You know, I wanted to defend those kind of writings and write about some of these oddball novels like the Colonna novel I just mentioned and put it all together. So those two things kind of spurred me on to actually tackle this book.
So these critics were complaining about novels that were too difficult, that were not very accessible, and they wanted, I guess you might say, a more mainstream novel?
Exactly. They think the novel is kind of a community art form, you know, I don't know, like sports or something, something that everyone should be able to read, everyone can participate in. And they really don't like difficult intellectual kind of novels, novels that are written basically for writers, for other writers, or for grad students, novels with big vocabularies and esoteric allusions, that sort of thing. Again, that's exactly the kind of stuff I like. I couldn't help but see a parallel between, again, the growing conservatism in politics and this conservative outlook towards literature.
What's the connection there? Why would the election of George W. Bush in 2000 have anything to do with literary tastes?
Well, again, just a growing movement towards conformity that in the culture in general. I was a teenager in the 60s, and there's things going on in the 60s and 70s that you can never get away with now on television and radio, a lot of other things. I don't understand why this turn towards conservatism would leak into literature as well, but that seemed to be happening. And I wasn't surprised because you probably know in history, whenever a totalitarian government takes over, the first thing they do is clamp down on avant-garde literature. They want social realist mainstream stuff. And that's probably going a little too far, but there's a connection between, I think, political conservatism.
Is this the old distinction between art and entertainment? Is that the line that you're drawing here?
Exactly. Yeah. Most novels, the stuff on the bestseller list is just for entertainment purposes only, which is fine. You know, we all need that. But there are some novelists who are going after art, not entertainment. They're writing for the ages, not for just the current bestseller list. And those are the people I'm interested in. And there seems to be some critics who feel that that's not what writers should be doing. You know, you should be just writing novels that everyone can understand for the current, you know, generation and let it go at that.
This is quite a sweeping indictment, I have to say, of a lot of what is considered literary fiction out there. I mean, going back to Jonathan Franzen, I mean, I think he's considered a serious novelist by most people, or I don't know, Ian McEwan, you know, name your famous writer who writes best-selling books. So you're saying that this is just entertainment.
Not all of it. I mean, there's an upper level where you can write artistically and yet not alienate anyone. So Franzen is a perfect example of that. He's, yeah, a little more literary than most writers, but he's still writing basically a 19th century novel. I mean, his novels are structured like something out of Dickens. And, you know, no serious composer today writes a 19th century symphony, or no painter tries to paint a 19th century naturalistic painting. They've all moved on, but there's a feeling in literature that writers should not move on, that we should still be rewriting Dickens and George Eliot. So, yeah, there's a Venn diagram overlap somewhere where there's entertainment and art. And the best writers can do that. Shakespeare, perfect example, someone's entertaining as well as ultra-literary. But let's face it, most writers are writing just entertainment or art, and I'm on the art side, obviously.
I would guess that a lot of people would say that if you were to, I don't know, trace the development of the experimental novel, maybe you go back to James Joyce's 1922 novel, Ulysses, considered sort of the great experimental novel of our age. You're saying it goes way back before then, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at something like Petronius' Satyricon, which was written in about 60 A.D. It looks like a Thomas Pynchon novel. People break out in songs in the middle of it. There's people going off on various tangents. There's very highfalutin literary allusions throughout. I mean, it looks very much like the kind of thing that something like Thomas Pynchon or William Gaddis would write. There's a writer, Achilles Titius, who wrote about 3rd century A.D., a novel that is likewise, this is very unusual and weird. And then there's Sanskrit novelists in the 6th century who are writing, again, like Joyce, with multi-leveled punning language that could be read on several different levels and whatnot. So, yeah, there's always been that kind of writing going on.
So these people are always playing with the language in some way.
That seems to be the focus, yeah. And in fact, I think that's the main difference between entertainment and art when it comes to literature. Entertainment is mostly interested in just a story, lovable characters and all that, whereas art is really concerned about language. I mean, that's the one thing that distinguishes literature from all the other arts, obviously. Movies tell stories, ballet tells stories, but novels, it's all about language. So I think the most experimental and the most interesting novelists for me are those who really put all the emphasis in the language and manipulation of language.
Now, if we go back deep into literary history, let's say back to Aristotle in ancient Greece, he had rules for how one should write poetry and drama. But did he talk about prose fiction at all?
No, he didn't, nor did his counterparts in India and other places. And I think it's because, first of all, there probably weren't that many novels. A lot of them have been lost over the ages, but even those that survived indicate that there weren't that many. And they just didn't take it that seriously. So they made all the rules for poetry and drama, but let novelists do whatever they want, which is one of the great things about the early novels. They just do anything they want. It's like the Wild West, and that's what makes them so fun. And almost every novelist was a experimentalist in one sense, because they were trying new things. I mean, there are no rules they had to follow, and they could indulge in magic realism or do this or do that. In fact, even 50 years ago, when you went to college and studied literature, you studied drama and poetry. Even back in World War II, the novel wasn't really taught that often in college.
As if it wasn't real art. It was, like the ugly stepchild of the true literary arts.
Sure. It's like 50 years ago, music critics never wrote about rock music. You know, they just didn't consider that to be true music. And I think for a long time, until recently, the novel was that sort of bad boy, that wasn't, worth paying attention to.
Now, you mentioned that one of the things that got you launched onto this whole project was the discovery of this Renaissance novel by Francesco Colonna. Can you tell me about this book? What makes it extraordinary?
Yeah, it's hard to describe. Yes, it's a dream. This guy just dreams about this woman that he has a yearning for, but he's also a huge fan of classical architecture. So he wanders through this dreamscape looking at these enormous, gigantic buildings and describing them in great detail. But there's a kind of sensuousness about him that he seems to be also describing his lost love at the same time. And he goes through one adventure after another that's constantly going back and forth between his love for this woman and these enormous buildings that he describes in great length. The book is a famous book among architects rather than literary people for that reason. Again, the language, though. Colonna came up with his own combination of his own late Italian and then Greek words and Latin, and then just playing around with the language as much as he can to make it almost impossible to translate. I think that's why no one translated until about 10 years ago.
And what's the name of the book again?
It's called the Hypnerotomachia Polyphily, which is like the love strife of Polyphilo, who's the main character in a dream. It's a kind of complicated title.
Now, there's a lot of hand-wringing these days about the future of the novel. I mean, some people say that it's dying, that there's not a market for it anymore, especially as there is more competition from other kinds of media, from movies, TV, the internet, and all of that. And I guess I'm wondering what all of this means for the future of the experimental novel.
Taking the long view, as I do in my book, there have always been those kind of writers and always will be. The audience for that kind of stuff has always been small, unfortunately, except for a few exceptions like Joyce or Thomas Pynchon. So they'll continue going on. I do see, the literary sensibility seems to be shrinking a little bit. 40 years ago, a lot more people were reading this kind of stuff than they are now. Lots more distractions, I suppose. But the literary novel may shrink to what poetry is nowadays, something that's really read and appreciated just by a small coterie of readers. But it'll always be there, and there'll always be readers like myself that'll read them.
Stephen Moore is the author of the novel An Alternative History, Beginnings to 1600. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Moore's currently working on the second volume, which will start with Cervantes in 1600 and end in 1800. So, what do you think of Stephen Moore's thoughts about the novel? Do you care if a novel breaks new ground? Do you have any favorite experimental novels you'd like to recommend? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there. Coming up, a novel written in the form of liner notes to fictional music, and a novel written like the transcripts of parliamentary debates in a fictional province in Canada, as we conclude our Hour on Novel Novels. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Novelist Jonathan Coe has this to say about Christopher Miller's debut novel, Sudden Noises from Inanimate Objects. Funny, sinister, and endlessly inventive. What Nabokov did for poetry in Pale Fire and John Lanchester did for food in The Debt to Pleasure, Christopher Miller has now done for music in this demonically sly little novel. As Christopher Miller admits, his demonically sly little novel takes a rather unusual form.
Yeah, it's written in the form of liner notes to the complete works of an eccentric 20th century composer. I was thinking of those fat booklets of liner notes you sometimes get with box sets or opera recordings. And in one edition of the book, there was a Dutch translation. For some reason, they actually did it in that format, 5 inches square or whatever that would be.
It sounds wonderful, but it's so odd. It's not an idea that clearly has inspired others, and I wondered what inspired you. Were you just reading a set of liner notes, and it suddenly occurred to you you could tell a story that way?
Well, I've always liked reading liner notes, especially when I lose interest in the music I'm listening to. As a writer, I relate more readily to words than to musical notes. The main character, the eccentric composer, started off as a minor character in another book I was writing, another novel that I abandoned. And I just had so much stuff about this composer. He was just one of those characters where I could put him in any situation and I'd know exactly how he would behave. He just generated all sorts of comic action, but it wasn't really connected by any sort of through plot. So I was casting around for a way to relate all these little fragments, all these little notes, and liner notes just occurred to me as a great way for a bunch of separate anecdotes instead of pretending that I had a linear story to tell when I didn't really.
Well, he's a fascinating character, too, and he is particularly appropriate for bits and pieces, for anecdotes. Simon Silber, you call him. I'm assuming that's the way it's pronounced.
Yes, yes.
He seems both completely odd and in some vague ways familiar. I mean, there are things about him that sound like Glenn Gould or John Cage, composers whose names are known without necessarily their music being very well known.
Glenn Gould was really the model for him, and maybe not so much for his compositions, but just for his eccentric personality, his shyness. Gould famously retired from the concert stage when he was 30, I think, his reclusiveness. I had just been reading a biography of Gould and just got really interested in that character and started creating this composer character who was sort of based on him. He was supposed to be like Glenn Gould, but not quite as good, so silver instead of gold.
Of course, the other main character in this book is the person who's telling the story, who's writing these liner notes, with a really lovely name, I have to say, Norman Fairweather Jr.
Yeah. Silver's Fairweather friend.
Yes. I was hoping it was that obvious. Yeah.
And the junior is important, too, because he has an inferiority complex. His father is a famous scholar. It's partly rebelling against the status quo, which has glorified his father, that leads Fairweather to this obscure, marginal composer.
Of course, what's always fascinating about writing of this sort is that it reveals as much about the writer as about the subject, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. And I feel that both of those characters are sort of funhouse mirror reflections of myself. I'm obviously a nicer, saner guy than either of them, but
well, of course.
They're both partly based on me.
Yeah. Norman Fairweather considers himself a creative type, something of a philosopher. Some of his aphorisms, and he writes a book of aphorisms, I think, some of them are really very clever, and some of them, well, they border on the trite, shall we say?
Yes, trite and the sort of mechanical or gimmicky. All A is B, but it's all BA. Things like that, just kind of facile wordplay.
The famous one, I think, is some people shudder to think and some think in order to shudder.
Right, right.
It's lovely in a way, but then you look at it and you think,
Yeah.
You could see how a very vain and grandiose aphorist could convince himself that that aphorism concealed depths of profundity, though obviously it doesn't.
Now, would you say the same thing about Simon? Is that what he would think or perhaps say of his own music, this wonderful stuff that no one else can do?
Yes, I think they both have delusions of grandeur. For some reason, I find those delusions endearing, I think because I have them myself. That people with no such delusions, people who are completely realistic about their talent and their prospects, are usually kind of depressing.
Well, I think that's why reading the book is so much fun, because you can't help but laugh a little at yourself, too, as you're going along.
Right, even as you feel superior to the characters because they're so crazy.
Yeah. I mean, would you read a little bit of Sudden Noises? Because I think it would be great to get a little of the flavor of it at this point and how you feel about it.
Okay, I'm going to read a passage that's a favorite of mine. It describes a convention of the New Composers Alliance, which is just a dozen obscure composers who all gather in Forest City, Silverstown. And this just sort of describes some of them and their work. The New Composers Alliance wasn't a movement or school. As far as I could tell, in fact, the only thing that our composer had in common with his fellow members was a lack of interest in all music but his own, including that of fellow members. Otherwise, they were a motley bunch. Altschul, who had just finished the 30-year task of composing a different suite of miniatures for every interjection in Webster's, 24 ahs, 24 ahas, 24 ahems, 24 ahoys, 24 alacks, 24 alasses, 24 amens, etc. Batcock, whose instrumental works incorporated laugh tracks every time the music did something humorous, though I, for one, have always been skeptical about claims of humor in instrumental music, like claims of flavor in cigarette ads. Cowlick, who for years had confined himself to the note of middle C, not just the key, but the note, varying only the volume, duration, and instrumentation. Earlywine, who kept developing new instruments with names like the trombonium, the pseudobassoon, and the acoustic synthesizer, in order to be the first composer to write music for them. Goodenough, whose music involved so much repetition and so many formulas for rapid expansion of shorthand notations that he was able, with the aid of a computer program of his own devising, to write music in less time than it took to hear. To write a fully orchestrated 30-minute tone poem in 15, for instance. Pilcrow, who, congenitally deaf, wrote only Augenmusik, music meant to be seen and not heard. And Webb, like Silber, better known as a performer, though unlike Silber, he was still performing, and presumably, like any serious musician, practicing several hours a day, every day, on his chosen instrument, the gong.
I can hear you smile as you read. it must have given you great joy to come up with these things that don't exist.
I had a lot of fun. It's probably my favorite part of writing is, as you say, coming up with things that don't exist. And I usually wind up with more than I can actually fit in the final book.
I'm just curious. Are there any recordings that you had in mind that sound the way you think a Simon Silber composition might sound?
As I say, he's sort of based on Glenn Gould. And I think that like Gould, he hums or sings along on some of his recordings. I was actually thinking of Robert Schumann and his suites of miniatures. Silber writes only for piano because he doesn't want anyone else to perform his music, and he's a pianist. Very short pieces that are almost closer to aphorisms than to full-length works of music. So pieces like Kinderscene and Scenes from Childhood was the model for Silber's Variations in a Minor. Schumann wrote a bunch of those suites, and they're actually what he was best at. He also wrote symphonies and quartets because back then composers felt they had to be taken seriously, but he was really best at these miniatures. Another composer would be John Cage. I have one record, I forget what it's called, but he just laid music paper over a star chart for like the stars visible in the Australian skies and just wrote a note wherever there was a star. So I had that in mind for Silber's composition, Crows, where he just transcribes the birds on the telephone wires.
Listening to that music, you can almost hear both Simon Silber and Norman Fairweather, can't you?
Yes, yes. They're both aphorists and both cranks, I would say.
I'm curious to know what you think about the future of the novel. Do you think that the novel has to continue to evolve to compete with our ever-evolving mediascape? TV, films, video games, the internet?
I feel like the big competition now is with the internet, just because I'm so addicted to it myself. And I used to scandalize my colleagues at Bennington by saying I decided that the internet was better than literature, which I don't really believe, but it was a fun thing to say.
A good conversation starter. Or yes. A good harangue starter. I'm not sure which.
Or conversation ender, as the case may be. I'm really trying to detox from the internet because I've gotten so addicted. And I think if you spend too much time on it, fiction starts to seem slow moving. And, you know, you want hyperlinks. You want to be able to click on the page and be somewhere else suddenly. I mean, I think that actually my take on fiction is kind of similar to that. You know, I always liked to have a lot of things going on the page. I used to say that I have a sort of three-ring circus aesthetic. It's funny, but with this novel writing now, one of the injunctions I've been giving myself is make it as fun as the internet. I don't know if that's possible, and I don't know if it's wise. I mean, I don't want to feel that novelists are selling their birthright by trying to copy the internet. Yeah. The way painters for a while tried to paint as realistically as possible to compete with photography. You just can't do it. You have to find out what your own medium is good for.
Christopher Miller is the author of Sudden Noises from Inanimate Objects, a novel in liner notes. Miller's also written another very funny and inventive novel called The Cardboard Universe, A Guide to the World of Phoebus K. Dank. It's written in the form of an encyclopedic reader's guide to the life and work of a fictional author who bears a certain resemblance to the legendary science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. Jeff Bercy is a Canadian author and reviewer. His new book is called Verbatim, a Novel. It's set in a fictional province in Canada, and it's presented in the form of The Hansard. Bercy told Anne Strainchamps what The Hansard is.
Anyone who's familiar with the congressional record knows that there's a written record of what politicians say. And in every legislature, I imagine that there would be something that would, some organization, some division that would do the same thing. In the Commonwealth system, the parliamentary system, which means, to give a short list, the UK, Canada, Australia, and so forth, there's a division within each legislature. It's sometimes called Hansard, sometimes called parliamentary publications, and it's the written record of what is said in the House.
So you've basically chosen to write a novel in the form of essentially the congressional record?
I'm not as familiar with the congressional record as the Hansard, but let's say something like that, yes.
What inspired you?
I was working in Hansard in Newfoundland from 1990 to 2000. I finished the book in 1995. I was kind of inspired by the environment that I was working in because I would hear politicians, well, each and every day, for many hours every day. And I thought there has to be a way to capture this in fiction, and it has to be a way that doesn't go the boring route, which is trying to figure out what's in the backbencher's mind. I think that has been done many times. And I thought, let's discuss what people do in a legislature. Mm-hmm. So nothing that I would have special access to, but you yourself could visit the legislature. And it's quite a hopping place in Wisconsin at times, I understand. You could visit it.
It has been recently.
Yes, you could visit it and see for yourself what the members actually do on the floor. Mm. I thought, I'll present that instead of presenting what's in the minds of people, because how we govern ourselves is really important to us. It's what we contribute to, and it's our civic obligation to know how we govern ourselves.
We should hear an excerpt in order to get a sense of it. Is there a bit you could read for us?
Sure. Which would you like me to read? A letter or a debate or something?
Oh, a debate would be fun.
Okay. Well, I can't read you both sides because I only have, you know, I guess, a couple of minutes or something, but I'll read you a part of a member's debate. So this takes place in the House, and a member of an opposition party named Mr. Lewis is addressing the Premier, and he's telling him that the poor in the province are going to come marching into town out of desperation due to the economic state of this province in the 1990s. So I'll just launch in there. The 8,000 people will be heard from miles away, and you're going to hear them some night when you're lying in bed, stuffed like a pig with truffles, caviar, and champagne, sleeping with a heavy stomach and the TV flickering in the room, glasses of wine and nuts and fruit all over the place. The Premier of this land has to be well rested to make important decisions, and one night he'll be woken from a dream. He'll go to the front door, careful not to wake his wife, and before he opens it, the sound of boots will hit him. Oh yes, no mistake. He'll stand there in the porch and think, "No, this can't be happening. I ate some bad clams or mussels, or the port was off." Soon it'll sink into him and he'll be petrified. He'll grip his thick bathrobe and say, "My God, it's the people. They're marching on me like the opposition said they would." Next thing, the Minister of Justice gets a phone call and she hears this panicked voice saying, "Send the riot police, the paddy wagons, the horses and dogs. Arrest them all for waking me, the Premier. Charge them with disturbing the peace, for anything, but get them off the street, out of the city. Beat them back into the miserable country where they come from." I see that happening, but it can be stopped. Create jobs, Premier.
That's fantastic.
Well, that's a nice response.
Oh, now some of my favorite bits actually have somewhat less content. There's just this constant back and forth during the question periods. And there's this thing the some of the honorable members, almost like a Greek chorus, you know, respond. Sometimes it's "hear, hear," and other times it's "oh, oh."
Well, we think of a legislative assembly, or you would think of your legislature down there, as a continuation of Greek democracy, even though what the Greeks of ancient times thought democracy was would look very different to us. But the Greek chorus, as you say, is certainly picking up on that, so that there is this "oh, oh, hear, hear," a kind of tragic, modified tragedy, obviously, for what is occurring in the House. There could be things about a mining disaster, and people will go, "oh, oh," or "shame, shame," or "resign, resign." And this is the debased chorus that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, aside from the amusement value of all of this, are there some deeper issues lurking here? I mean, are you concerned about the devolution of, you know, our governmental system?
I'm concerned and have been since I wrote the book about being interested in how we choose to be led. We go into a voting booth and we elect somebody. And what are our motivations behind that before we make the X? Do we want the noblest person? Do we want a person who we just think we're voting for because we like that party? What is our thinking process? That's one thing. But when the members are actually there conducting the business that they have said to everybody that they want to go and do, then they are part of a structure. And we are part of that structure because, I don't know if it's viewed down there the same way as it is here, but the House is our house.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we are. We have representatives. So if they are speaking on our behalf, then we should know what they're doing. And if we agree with them, then that's great. And if we don't agree with them, why don't we? And what would we do differently? I think looking again at how we govern ourselves is very important. There are deeper issues about being conscious of the choices that we make. And if we think that there's something wrong in this book with how the parliamentary system works, if somebody has that opinion, or if they think it's absolutely right and it goes along fine as it is, then either people will think, "Well, I need to do something to change it," or "it looks good as it is."
Now, in this book, it's not only the politicians in the legislature who are at one another's throats. The bureaucrats responsible for producing the Hansard are also feuding. Can you describe a bit of that storyline?
Certainly. The Hansard itself is usually a small division within legislatures. It's nonpartisan. Many people don't know what Hansard is. I mean, within government, they don't know what Hansard is. So they're not often noticed. And when they are noticed in the House, sometimes it's either thanked very briefly for their services during a sitting, or there's an error in what you produced. Those are the only two kinds of attention. And so they're a kind of invisible group, and they can only fight amongst themselves. Nobody else cares about them, really.
Is there an excerpt from one of these memos you could read to us?
Sure. So this is a letter that comes from one of the two editors, and it's to the director. The editors were asked to reply to a new style book that was imposed by the director. Now, it was imposed because the two editors didn't want to get along with him and make changes. So here's what one of the editors has to say. "You asked for a response, and I've got some things to say. I don't like some of the changes. What's wrong with administration? You want a lowercase a? All right. There's not a problem there, but I still don't see the reason. You also talked about effect and affect, how we're to know their different uses, and inquiry and inquiry. When you're scrolling through a document that's thousands of words long, you don't pay too much attention to one letter. The world won't turn upside down or collapse if we leave effect for effect. I take your point about being consistent, but Tell that to the transcribers when you have your meetings. Dashes. I use them. Why not? The members don't speak in complete sentences. But the other editor likes to use colons and semicolons. Well, dashes are real speech, and that's what we're transcribing, not lectures. There are all kinds of points you raised, but basically, this comes down to attitude and professionalism, and those are hard things to merge. Good luck. Meet us on some middle ground, and maybe we'll be able to do it. But look, no one's complained about the Hansard up to now, so why all the fuss?
Boy, what's alarming about that is I think that anybody who's ever worked for any length of time in a bureaucracy will completely relate.
Well, that's good. For me, anyway.
Do you think, in fact, more than just that we should embrace many different sorts of novels, do you think the novel actually needs to continue to evolve in order to remain relevant, especially in this day and age when there are so many, many different forms of narratives all around us?
I think the novel can't help but evolve. That's what it's been doing since whenever you want to backdate it to. It has evolved to include a book like mine. But it could be a book that's based on junk mail. It could be a book that incorporates post-it notes. It could be like B.S. Johnson's novel, The Untouchables from 1969, which is a box with paper in it. And you can shuffle the contents as you wish and come up with whatever story you want to. I mean, that's from 1969. You could just as easily think of any form that the novel can be. There is no limit to it. We came up with this term, the novel. It's a fictional creation, like it didn't come out of a stone or get handed to us in some fashion. We invented it. So since we invented the term, why don't we just reinvent it as we go? It's ours. We made it up, after all. It's as much a creation, that term, the novel, as a novel itself is. So we're going to move ahead. We're going to evolve. There's not a doubt in my mind that that's what will happen. I don't think we should give up on our capacity as imaginative human beings to take something that looks old and to give it a new interior as well as an exterior. I don't think novelty just for novelty's sake is very interesting, but something original, now that is interesting.
Jeff Bercy is the author of Verbatim, a novel. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 612A, Novel Novels. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from N. Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Today's engineer is Steve Gotcher.
PRI, Public Radio International.